I don't think the first century church would have divided over which Caesar took the throne. The church is dividing over secular politics. Satan has to be doubled over laughing. Yeah, I just want Christians to wake up and smell the gospel.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. You've joined us for The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian every week and hear something of their life story. And today on the show, I'm pleased to say that I'm joined by the New York Times best-selling author and biblical scholar, Preston Sprinkle. Preston is the co-founder and president of the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender, and he often tackles tough topics, including sexuality, gender, race, violence, patriotism, hell, politics, war, you name it. And he also hosts his own popular podcast entitled Theology in the Raw, where all these things and more get discussed. Preston's latest book is entitled Exiles, The Church in the Shadow of Empire. Preston, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Sam. Excited to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. I mentioned in that introduction that you often like to discuss what we might call hot potatoes. I don't know if you've got that that phrase in the US, but there's sort of hot button issues, cultural big issues, the kind of issues that are often actually quite divisive and difficult, especially for Christians. Why do you think it is that you're drawn to those sorts of topics so often?
You know, I honestly don't know how to answer that. I'm not a controversial person. I don't like conflict, you know. I don't like to poke people just to poke people. I think years ago when I started my academic career, I was studying things that nobody seemed to care about, you know, individual verses buried in Leviticus, you know. I wrote my dissertation on Leviticus 18:5b and nobody wanted to read a 300-page treatise on Leviticus 18:5b. And so I don't know. I kind of grew a passion to want to wrestle with things that people are actually talking about. Turns out people are usually talking about things that are controversial and divisive. And so, yeah, I think it was more out of my love for wanting to help the church think more biblically about things they're thinking about. And those just happen to be, I guess, hot topics.
Yeah. I always like to go back to the beginning and hear about a person's kind of early life growing up. So tell me something of your childhood and I guess where the Christian faith first came into the picture for you.
I became a committed Christian at 19. I was a nominal Christian before that. And one fun fact is that I absolutely hated to read or study or even be behind a desk, you know, as a teenager. I guess pretty natural for teenagers. But I didn't read a book cover to cover until I was 17 years old. You know, I just hated it. But when I got saved at 19, I prayed over that verse in James 1:5, where it says, if anybody lacks wisdom, pray and God will give it generously. And I did that thinking I would wake up, you know, that God would like download a bunch of information in my head, like the Matrix or something. And it just didn't happen. But almost overnight, I developed an insatiable passion to want to study and read the Bible. I would lock myself in a room for 6-7 hours and just could not stop reading. I would turn down social events just to sit in my room and study the Bible. And so that was weird. I would say it was an act of God. And so that passion hasn't really left me. I mean, I don't claim any natural intelligence. People see the PhD behind my name and I'm like, well, don't let that fool you. I work really hard and I love to study, but I felt like a fish out of water in the PhD program, man. There's people that have read the New Testament in Greek backwards and forwards. And I was like, I just barely got through it in English, you know, not quite, but I absolutely love wrestling with what God's word has to say to us.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that so much of your work is written for that popular level. I mean, you've deliberately written books that can be read by the likes of me who don't have a PhD. And not everyone in academia goes that route. Some people enjoy doing the more detailed academic work. You seem to try and straddle both worlds or perhaps even have a slight preference for the popular level stuff. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. I love the academic research. My 3-4 years in my PhD program at Aberdeen University was just heaven on earth, just studying 12, 14 hours a day. I love reading academic work. I did find it hard writing like an academic, largely because I kept thinking, like, I could say this a lot more clearer. But I almost felt like you had to put on this academic air and use big words and long sentences and almost, yeah. So once I got done with my PhD and started writing more, they call it thoughtful trade. It's sort of in between academic and just pop stuff. I just felt so relieved that I had the freedom to just speak, just write as if I'm speaking, just write in my own voice. And yet still have, pages of footnotes to show I've done the research, but I want to communicate this to somebody who, like you said, who doesn't have a PhD. So yeah, I love living in that space because I like both worlds. I love the research and I love writing normally.
And you're someone who writes and speaks, and in some senses you're teaching people. But of course, you're not a church pastor or even a teaching pastor. Has that ever been sort of asked of you? Why aren't you a church leader, Preston? Do you ever fancy, becoming a church leader?
Oh, okay. Let me see how I can answer this. I have been on a teaching team at churches. I've been a lay elder, or even there's one church I was a paid. They paid me to speak once a month. Another church I was on a teaching team. So I definitely have been in, heavily involved in the church. Never like a full-time senior or associate pastor. Everything I do is because I love the church and want to see the church thrive. And I don't know, it's kind of weird. I feel like I can do that better if I'm not nailed down with a particular church. That comes with certain demands that I don't think I'm gifted at. It comes with certain politics that I despise. I think that the freedom I have to, I guess, be me and help pastors think through these things. And I've had a pastor tell me this. He said, "Don't ever get a full-time church job. You would lose your influence on the church." It's kind of odd to that's just. I hope I'm not saying that as a blanket statement for everybody, but I do think I can better serve the church and serve leaders in the position that I'm in. And I do speak. I mean, I probably there was one year I spoke in a church context. I think over 100 times. It was something where I added it up and it was like more than your average pastor. So I'm in churches speaking all the time. It's just I'm just not paid by one particular church
Yeah.
or going, doing that at one church.
And is that partly because that does allow you a level of freedom? You don't have to tick certain number of theological or doctrinal boxes. You don't have to agree with any one church's list of criteria. I suppose there's something in your work, especially in a podcast like Theology in the Raw, where the clue's in the name, but you're wrestling with stuff and it's not a kind of set position, but you're opening questions. Do you think there's that's seen as a bit too much of a threat, perhaps, by some churches that you could leave things so open?
I think it very well could. I think I do. I could think of a number of churches that would be like, "Hey, we would love to have you as you." I still think they would get some emails here and there. I mean, I hosted, not even hosted, the church I currently attend. It's Calvary Chapel Boise. Love the staff; they're awesome. We host an Exiles in Babylon conference every year there. About 1,000 people fly in, come to the conference, and they just rent us the space. They don't advertise it. They don't mention it. They're not sponsors. They're not. All they're doing is giving up their building on a Thursday through Saturday. And I heard through the grapevine that a bunch of people left the church because of that. So imagine if I was actually on staff there, or they had me preach there. I've never been asked to preach there, and probably a good thing. So I mean, if a church simply opens up its space for a theology conference that some people disagree with, and also the pastor spent weeks meeting with people, they're getting emails, all this misunderstanding of what it is, and so I'm like, man, I created a bunch of headache for this one church, poor church, simply by allowing them to rent space to us, So yeah, so I can only imagine other churches if I was actually more public. It could hopefully it would do more good than harm, but yeah, I guess it kind of depends on the church.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I meet Christians on both sides of this one. I meet Christians who are very sure in what they believe, don't want to spend actually a lot of time opening up every issue and questioning everything, and they're quite happy with sometimes what's described as quite a simple faith in Jesus, and I'm good. I mean, other Christians just love wrestling with this stuff and will read opposing opinions, take delight in reading books they don't agree with, and it strikes me that your background in academia is really helpful for the part of the church that perhaps is afraid sometimes of questions or opening things up, because you're coming from a background where it's quite normal to engage with opposing points of view. But there is clearly still that resistance. And what do you say to a Christian who says, look, that's fine for you, Preston, you're asking all the big questions, but for me, I just don't need to go there. I'm happy. Me and Jesus, we're happy.
Yeah.
You know, don't open up this massive topic of hell and try and tell me I'm wrong. I'm good where I am, you know?
You know, over the years, I've been hopefully much more accommodating to just the different ways people are wired. So I would probably say, oh, good for you, man. Go preach the gospel, lead people to Jesus, disciple people around you, and I'll see you on the other side. Yeah, but it's great. Like I would still say we are all called to love the Lord our God with our heart, mind, soul, and strength. God gave us these amazing minds that set us apart from the animal kingdom. You know, like it's it's part of how we created God's image. So don't waste that. But I get it. My wife would be wired that way. Like she it would stress her out to kind of get into these like theological debates and everything. She uses her mind on a relational level in amazing ways. She will dig into people. She has a sixth sense where she can see right. She don't try to BS my wife. She'll catch it right away. She's like, no, you're not telling. I'm like, how'd you know I'm not telling the truth? You know. So people are wired differently. As long as you are using your mind, then you don't need to be, you know, thrilled with wrestling with all these theological issues and stuff. So, but yeah, if it's somebody just using it as a cop out, or if they actually are passionate about something, you know, this view is right. I'm like, well, actually, let's talk about that. Well, no, I don't want to get into it. I'm like, well, then maybe you should. Maybe the level of your passion should match the depth of your study. So if your depth of your study is admittedly very thin, then maybe be a little more open-handed with this viewpoint you know are so passionately about. So, yeah, that's an interesting question, Sam.
The level of your passion should match the depth of your study is a fascinating line to think about, isn't it? And I think there's a lot to dig into there. We will, of course, talk about some of the big issues. How could we not? Just before we get there, though, have you ever doubted your faith? By which I mean just the whole thing, not an individual issue, but just the big picture stuff of like, you know, did Jesus resurrect? Did he even walk the earth? Am I wasting my time? As St. Paul says, you know, if the resurrection hasn't happened, we're people to be most pitied. You know, are those sorts of real deep, dark doubts ever been a struggle for you?
Yeah, I would say on some level, yes. I say on some level because I quickly think of what are the other options, and then I'm back to, I think of all the options, you know, atheism or other religious, you know, possibilities. I'm like, no, of all the other options, Christianity is the most, I think, the most verifiable. I think tells the most beautiful story. People are like, what about the Canaanites? What about that? No, I'm not saying there's not problems. I'm just saying, look at the other options. You know, I think full on atheism would just lead me into just pure nihilism. Personally, that's like, that's where I would go. I wouldn't care. I wouldn't have any moral framework. I wouldn't have any reason to abide by any kind of external moral pressure. For me, it's not so much the Bible. I'm fine with tensions and difficult things in the Bible, and I don't need to solve them. If I were God, I don't know if I would have needed to slaughter all the Canaanites, you know. And I know there's debates about whether that's the best way to read that event. There's things in Scripture that I'm like, yeah, I don't have a great answer for why that happened. Or solve the contradiction between the genealogies in Luke and Matthew and all these things. You know, I don't need to solve all those. I think I could solve many of them, and that's satisfying to me. So I don't really doubt the biblical story. For me, it's the personal side of the faith. I'm like, if Jesus is my personal friend, you know, then how come I don't feel him like I used to? Why doesn't he just peel back the heavens and say, I'm here. Look at me. I'm real. Like, again, if I wanted people to know that I exist, I would just pull back the sky, pop my head in, and say, "What's up? Better believe, you know, like, why is God feel so hidden, both existentially and just emotionally sometimes?" And then, and that, again, this is my story. I know people that just say, you know, they feel God like he's almost more than they feel like an embodied person. So yeah, I sometimes I'm like, man, am I just walking with some invisible friend? And, you know, does he exist? And it's usually my intellectual side that kicks into gear and says, no, like, okay, we have to have, we all have some belief system. And is there a better option? I'm like, well, no, not at all. And so I think I bring myself back to the beauty and compellingness of the biblical story, that God is real, that sometimes you don't feel him like you're told you're supposed to. And so, yeah. So doubt, you know, comes in waves from different angles, I guess.
Yeah. I think that personal level is really helpful for people. And it does bring me on quite nicely to a book you wrote called People to Be Loved. And it strikes me, my memory of that book was the entire world was talking a lot about the issue, quote unquote, of homosexuality in the church, and how do we wrestle with these scriptures. And the title of that book summed up the message. Hang on, these are people, people who you know, people in your church, before this is an issue. And there's a very personal nature to actually what has become something that quite often people seemingly quite like to debate or even throw stones at each other over. Think, well, actually, these are real people's lives. Nevertheless, that book, it did come down in a kind of traditional orthodox perspective in terms of the rights and wrongs of homosexuality. But I think it's fair to say that some of your work in this area has actually challenged those who sit on that more traditional end of the theological spectrum, let's say. And I wondered if you could speak to that. So if someone's listening to this who would say, well, I believe what the Bible says, man, marriage is between one man and one woman, I agree with Preston. Is it more complicated than that? Are there shades of gray here that actually people on that side of the argument need to hear, whilst you would still affirm that biblical orthodox position?
It's a great question. And yeah, that book rocked my own world. It really is almost like it's almost like a journalistic narrative. Like the book kind of is documenting almost in real time. Now books are finished a year before they come out, so I mean, it's, you know, not that real time, but it's almost documenting my inroad in the conversation. So yeah, long story short, you know, raised conservative evangelical Christian, so there was no discussion about what the Bible says. It just, we all know what it says, it's wrong, whatever it is, it's wrong, you know, just that's it. But I began to see that there's a much more, in the academic world, there was a bigger debate about what the Bible says. So I started to get interested in that on the academic side. So, you know, reading the books, reading the commentaries, doing word studies, looking at the passages. But then early on in my journey, this is probably 2013, maybe 2014, 2013, not 2013. I started to just get to know gay people because I didn't know any gay people. I was in a conservative bubble. And even 10 years ago, people weren't as visible. And so I just would get to know gay people just to hear their story. And I remember being really saddened that they were so shocked that a Christian would actually just want to hear their story. I was like, well, that sucks. What do you mean? Like, no Christian has just said, hey, what's it like to be you? That's a very basic Christian thing to say. Like, no. In fact, I never met a Christian that was kind to me. I'm like, what? So I began to just have this, I went through almost like just a relational just overhaul in my mind and heart, just meeting people that I really, truly, I began to enjoy. I almost felt guilty because I was like, I would sit down and have lunch with somebody who's gay and we'd be laughing, talking about movies, talking about life. And just like, I'm like, man, I'm really enjoying this person. I'm like, am I allowed to do that? And just that feeling of like, why wouldn't I be allowed to? I just had a fun conversation with my racist neighbor the week before. You know, I went to lunch with some person who's wealthy and not giving their money to the poor, like violating scripture all over the place. And I can't hang out with somebody just because they're gay, you know? So yeah. So I began to just dig deeper and deeper in that relational side and just found out that so many gay people, at least in the States, were raised in a church and were just either mistreated or horribly mistreated, like mistreated in the sense of, when they said, hey, I think I might be gay, people just kind of shunned them, maybe shamed them, like didn't talk to them. Like that's like the best case scenario. This is in my journey hearing these stories. I think it's different now a little bit. And worst case, I've got horrible stories. I can't even repeat on the air of how gay people were treated in the church. And that just seeps down into the reputation of the church. It seeps down into the LGBTQ community's perception of the church. And so when you meet an angry gay activist marching through your town in June, Christians just get angry. I'm like, what if we just stopped and asked, why do you think they might be so angry at Christians? How many of these people were raised in the church? How were they treated in the church? Like, just peeling back the layers of this, the relational side of this conversation. So that really rocked my world. It didn't change my theology. In fact, the more I looked into the theology, I know I'm not allowed to say this as an academic, but I think the Bible is remarkably clear on its definition of marriage. But I don't, yeah, I see Jesus, you know, who has a very high ethical standard, absolutely loving and wanting to hang out with people who aren't living according to that standard. And so I just think the church should live in that space better than it has. And yeah, the church has come a long way. I think sometimes I fall into bashing the church in this conversation, and I want to challenge a church and continue to do that. But I've been around the country, the world really, and have met amazing pastors and leaders who are in relationship with the gay people, having people over for dinner, walking with people who are wrestling. So I'm hopeful for what the future holds.
A few months ago now, we had a guest on this show who I know you've dialogued with a lot on this issue, which is Rosaria Butterfield. And she didn't mention you by name during the interview, but I know online you've had various backs and forths. And I suppose she represents a side of this argument, which would say if you are that we should not affirm, you know, the desires that people have. If someone has a gay inclination, let's say, then they should be taught to resist that. You see things slightly differently to that, and we don't have time to go into all the weeds of the debate, but I think, you know, how would you respond to someone who says, well, being gay is a sin? Because that's quite often how it comes across, or the kind of language that people that Christians will use, saying being gay is a sin. You have a slightly different view on that. Could you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I think there's a confusion over what we mean when we say somebody is same-sex attracted or experiences same-sex attraction. Just that phrase can mean about four or five, six different things, or even being gay. What does it mean to be gay? So I really think that this debate can be clarified in a five-minute conversation, if we can have that. But yeah, I don't think we should affirm anybody's sinful desire. I think some desires can be sinful.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
Contrary to what people think I believe lust is a sin. I've had people quote Matthew 5 at me saying, Jesus said, if you look at a woman with lust, you know, I'm like, I know. I agree. I quote it in my books all the time, you know. But I don't think same-sex attraction in and of itself is lust, any more than I think opposite sex attraction is lust. Like when I say I am opposite sex attracted, that by definition means I am attracted to females, not males. That means I'm quote unquote attracted to 4 billion people on the planet. And if people throw Matthew 5 in my face, I'm like, well, hold on. That doesn't mean I'm like walking around like wanting to have sex with every single one of these 4 billion. It just means on a general level, if I'm going to experience a sexual desire or say a sexual temptation, it's going to be toward the opposite sex, not the same sex. And this is exactly all the gay people I talk to, how they would describe their same-sex attraction. They would say, I can go through the whole week and maybe I might encounter a temptation here and there, but I can go through a whole day and I'm still same-sex attracted. When I walk into a restaurant and I see men and women, I notice the men in a way that I don't notice the women, in the same way that I go into a restaurant and I'm very aware of the fact that I'm opposite sex attracted, even if I'm not tempted by anybody in the room. That's what people mean by same-sex attracted. They're not talking about an active sexual desire toward an individual person that they are wanting to sleep with. And I think that's when I hear some people talk about putting to death, you know, these sinful desires, and therefore, you know, same-sex attraction is sin. You need to put that to death. Like, well, that's not the way you're describing that sexual desire is not how people, what people mean when they say they're same-sex attracted. So, yeah, I think, I don't know if we're saying too many, we might still disagree, but I think there's some language clarification that could happen.
Yeah. And it does often come down to language, and something I've noticed, I've spoken to more people in this debate, is it's very easy to paint in broad brushstrokes, but actually we've got to be careful our language sometimes and not be talking across each other, for sure. Just to move the conversation on, I know you've also written on transgender, another huge issue, but perhaps moving on even one step further from that, recently for Premier Christianity magazine, Andrew Bunt wrote an article for us, and Andrew is from a group called Living Out, which is a Christian organization supporting same-sex attracted Christians who take a traditional view. And Andrew wrote that the next kind of battle, if you like, in this whole conversation is going to be polyamory, the idea that you can be in a relationship or a marriage with more than one person. And he cited various things, such as there was recently a week of visibility for non-monogamy. The subjects had a lot of media attention. There was a recent cover of New York Magazine looking at this. So it's just in the culture, it seems to be a conversation that you could be in a relationship with more than one person. I wanted to ask, you know, do you agree that's where the kind of next evolution of the LGBTQ conversation is going, or not? Because I know some people might say this is an alarmist overreaction, kind of borderline offensive, that you're saying to me as a gay person, I'm now going to be, you know, going to this level. That's not fair. You know, what's your view on where this conversation might go next?
Yeah, I've been saying the same thing Andrew said for years. I think I wrote an article in Christianity Today, now that I think of it, they got some backlash, I think 3 or 4 years or maybe 5 years ago, saying, you know, like pastors and leaders, we kind of missed the boat on the LGBT conversation, in the sense that we're constantly, backtracking and operating out of reaction, rather than being prepared ahead of time when we're starting to encounter different people. And so let's do that with polyamory. Let's get ahead of the game. Let's develop a level-headed theology, theological response. Let's not react in anger. Let's treat people as people and embody and articulate our sexual ethic in ways that reflect Jesus. So I don't think, and I'm very nervous about slippery slope kind of arguments. Well, if you go here, you're going to end up all the way over here. I was raised in an environment where everything was a slippery slope. And I like to remind people the slippery slope has two sides. if your slope leans conservative, you can end up as a Christian nationalist and end up on the side of the dragon in the book of Revelation. But I won't go there. To me, at least in the States, I think it's the same in the UK. The broadly speaking, the societal sexual ethic is, if it's consensual, if people are of age, and if it's not harming anybody else, then it's fine. In fact, you're kind of immoral if you don't say it's fine. Well, why wouldn't, I mean, polyamory by definition, you're not cheating. It's an open relationship where it's consensual. You're not harming anybody else. One could argue if you bring kids in that environment, that might be harming your, you know, the kids, but you're of age. You're not talking about minors here. At least most people aren't. The secular sexual ethic doesn't really say anything to prohibit polyamory. You might say it's not wise, or yeah, but there's been lots of tension and jealousy. Yeah. That might be true, but
and you see that already, I think, with the same sex question, with those who want to try and defend a traditional point of view, sometimes feel a bit stuck because they're saying, well, my friends are saying it doesn't harm you, doesn't hurt you, doesn't hurt us. What's the problem? Let us do it. So what is the response then? Whether it is LGBT issues, whether it's polyamory, what is the Christian response that's actually going to cut through? Because it seems to me like even a lot of people on the traditional side actually struggle with this question in their friendships. And they probably want to avoid the question if they're honest. Like, how do I explain a Christian worldview in a way that's going to make sense to my friend who's an atheist, or my friend who's LGBT? You know, do you have a couple of go-tos you'd sort of counsel people, say this is the kind of theology that you need to kind of grasp a hold of and then figure out how to express in your conversations?
Yeah, theologically, I mean, I think that John aligned from Genesis 1 and 2 to Matthew 19, and really other marriage passages, that the, sex difference in marriage, male and female, is intrinsically connected to the number 2. This is the exact point Jesus made in Matthew 19. That those two are, he's making the same point. He's affirming both of those goods with the same point, the same kind of argument. And he roots it back in Genesis 1 and 2, that God created the male and female, therefore man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So I do think the number 2 is not arbitrary. Part of it on a theological level comes in, plays into the role that procreation plays in marriage. That marriage, I would say, I think the Catholics are largely right here. That marriage is a procreative institution. It's oriented towards procreation. It's designed for the rearing of kids, in part, not that there's not other goods of marriage. And sometimes that doesn't work out through infertility or other things. But it still is, has a procreative orientation, because our sexed bodies, male and female, point to God's procreative design built into that. And I think a third member would interrupt that design. I would say, and you can go to, I mean, church history has affirmed this pretty unanimously. You can point to scriptures where, well, let me actually back up. This is something Christians need to know, is I would say, scripturally speaking, this is going to be one of my more shocking statements, Sam, so get ready. I think there is probably more scriptural justification for polyamory. And I think people know where I'm going with this, because we do have some positive statements about polygamy. I know it's not the same thing, but it still is a more than two relationship. You have polygamous relationships that are just kind of talked about, not addressed. Oftentimes they go bad in scripture, but you even have a passage like in, is it 2 Samuel 12, I think it is, where God's kind of rebuking David. Why'd you turn your back on me? Look at all these things I've done for you. Look at all these wives I've given you. And so all his wives, I shouldn't be laughing, all these wives is framed as like a blessing from God, there's, we don't have a parallel statement of a same-sex relationship in the Bible, where there's kind of like, ooh, but it's kind of positive here, or here's a same-sex relationship that's not condemned, here's a same-sex relationship that's included in God's blessing to the king. We don't have those passages to wrestle with. Now, to be clear, I think the Bible, as I already said, rules out. I think the Bible teaches, marriage between one man and one wife. It's just you have to be, I think, a little more thorough and careful in how you present the argument, and not just assume that polyamory just so obviously denounced by the Bible that you don't even need to think
Yeah,
about it.
you're right. You're right. If you're looking for scriptural examples and evidence, you're right. There are plenty of people in the Old Testament who had more than one wife. And that, I guess what you're saying is you've seen this coming for a long time. These are the sorts of apologetics kind of questions that Christians need to start wrestling with pretty quickly, because this could be the next issue that comes up in the culture. So there you go. There's some homework for us all to go away and do
Absolutely.
some reading up on those sorts of things. Sadly, we're running out of time in this interview, and I could ask 100 more questions on that subject. But I'm really keen to get to the new book, because the new book is out now, and it's called Exiles: The Church in the Shadow of Empire. Now, I've got to be honest, Preston. At first glance, it doesn't look like another hot topic. It doesn't look like a gender or sexuality or hell, which are all topics you've written on before. But I suppose once you get into it, once you start reading it, this does have the potential to be controversial. I think, if I may, especially for a US audience right now, given some of the politics, has that been, I mean, the book's been out a little bit of time. Has that been the reaction so far, that actually this is causing some controversy? Can you explain why it might? Why a book which, as I say, on the face of it, Exiles, Shadow of the Church, the Church in the Shadow of Empire, doesn't sound like it would, but I imagine it might have done.
You need to spend more time in the US. And to be clear, the book is, and I say this up front, it is a very US centric book, and I didn't want to, I'm writing from my own political position in the United States of America. And I didn't want to pretend like I knew anything about other people's context. So the American centric nature of the book was, it's out of really to give honor to other people, not pretend like I can speak into their context. So yeah, it is a huge problem in America. The allegiances that the church forms, to its political parties. And I'm trying to be fair here to both sides.
There is a perception here in the UK. The perception here is that the average, let's say, evangelical Christian in America, the average one, you know, will vote Republican yes. because they're pro-life or they're pro-Israel or another view, which they would say this, they take the biblical view. And it is, if I'm honest, it's probably a bit of a stereotype, but I'm sure there's truth in it. That's the perception here. That there's basically part of the church has kind of wedded itself to right-wing Republican politics. Now, you have to tell me if that's fair or not, but there is definitely that perception amongst a lot of Christians here in the UK that that's what's going on.
It's extremely fair, Sam. I would say most evangelical Christians would be, I would say, on a spectrum of what you just said. I know a lot of Christians who... They'll probably vote Republican. They will vote Republican. But they would say, I'm not really into politics. I'm pro-life. I'm this, that. I think Republicans are better at the economy. The Democrats seem to be doing some stuff I totally don't agree with, you know, advocating. They can't define what the word woman means, you know, or however they might frame it. So that would be, I think, the majority would just vote that direction, but they're not going to wear a MAGA hat. They're not going to go to a rally. I wouldn't consider them a Christian nationalist. I would consider them, you know, maybe patriotic, but not a Christian nationalist. Then you have the other, you know, the other end of that right wing perspective that is that they're wearing the MAGA hat. They would never go to a church if they knew there's a Democrat going to a church. I don't know if that more extreme position is growing. It certainly feels louder than it did four years ago. But I don't know if that's just more, everything seems loud these days because of social media. But yeah, your perception is 100% correct. Yeah. What I don't like to do is lump anybody who voted for Trump in this as the same kind of camp. You know, a lot of people voted for Trump in say 2016, largely because Hillary was so horrible that they're like, do I vote for the female dragon or the male dragon? You know, it's kind of like, comedian Bill Burr says, you know, what do we got? Like a racist dope or the devil? Like, who do I pick? You know, like, so I think a lot of Christians who do vote Republican, oftentimes they look at the other side or now, I mean, not pre Kamala, you know, they're like, this guy's, Biden's not even alive. And nobody seems to be aware of that until the debate finally. They'd be like, yeah, we've been seeing this for years. And like, that's the other option. So some people are like, if you had a better candidate, if you actually had RFK or somebody that was, you know, little more, whatever you think about him, a little more.
So that's a helpful kind of context to outline the context of the US. Just tell me a bit about, I guess, how your book speaks into that debate. Because I imagine it's not as simple as just you've written a book to tell Republican Christians not to vote Republican. I imagine that's not the desire here.
Not at all. And right now we're picking on right-wing Christians. I do very much address people who would just do the opposite on the other side. They're so anti-Trump that it's almost like they're investing theological hope in the other side. And I'm like, no, let's back up. Christians have a distinct political identity that should be detached, even opposed to the empire. And I do make a case that I do think that the United States is an empire, or at least empire-like. That's a important premise through the book. So all I do in the book is it's 85-90% Bible. I just do a biblical theology of what were a believer's, how would you describe a believer's political identity, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament? And it is, their political identity is significantly detached from the nations that they're living in. They're good citizens. They pray for the leaders. They submit to government authorities. But there's this ongoing submission yet subversion that the church takes in the New Testament. Even calling Jesus Kurios, Lord, that was a political statement. Caesar was called Lord. You call somebody else Lord, and it's like you're making a counterstatement towards the political powers. But the New Testament does that all over the place. It has a counter-imperial flavor to the gospel. So that's the main thing I kind of draw out. And then I make some points of application at the end that I just think Christians should have a healthy detachment, or that they shouldn't give their allegiances to any political party, that they should be suspicious.
Does that mean that a Christian couldn't run for office?
I don't go there. There were certain,
because I don't want to run for office in Babylon, surely.
Well, yeah. I didn't come down and say don't ever run for any office. I think that, at least in the States, it's a big difference between like local politics and more national politics. Big difference, you know. But yeah, I think Christians should have a healthy suspicion of the governmental powers. I think they believe in a completely different power system. They view money different. They view power different. They view how to get things done different. There's so many layers of values that just directly go against a Christian worldview that I don't think you should lay aside your Christianity and run for office. If you could bring your foot washing, upside down kingdom, you know, loving your enemy perspective, demilitarized perspective into your political position, then sure, go for it. I don't know I think Babylon's probably going to spit you out. I don't know if you can operate that way.
Yeah, I think there's a tension here. I mean, certainly in the UK, where I think many of us want to affirm that God can call people into politics. So I'd want to say, if God calls you into politics, you know, great, go for it. But then you do look even here in the UK at the political system and the fact you're probably going to have to join a political party and you're not going to be able to agree with everything that political party stands for. One does wonder, how on earth do Christian politicians do it? How do you stay true to your own Christian faith and put Jesus first whilst also being in a system and in a party that's going to ask of you to do some things that might contradict your conscience? I mean, I don't know how anyone really resolves that. I mean, I know there are good Christians in our parliament here in the UK and that we should be praying for them, but it does strike me as a very difficult arena for any Christian to go into.
I think so. And this is where I know the UK context is quite different than the US. I mean, with the history of the Anglican Church and it's I don't even know how you describe it, but there's an enmeshment. There's a relationship there that we don't have in the States. So this is where I did not want to speak categorically to everybody's context, because I know each one's different. But yeah, I would say this to any job. I mean, if you're gonna be a lawyer, and if you're gonna, you know, even the way, if you peek behind the political curtain and see how much money and people with power behind the scenes play in the system. I mean, you look at like the way all the different lobbies in the US and unelected wealthy people sway political, you know, sway politics just period. It's like, okay, so if you're a Christian, you cannot play into that. Can you give your finger to all the lobbies that are trying to win your, you know, trying to bend you this way, that way, make you, you know, be whatever? I just don't think you would last very long if you said, I am going to do what Jesus said in Mark 10, and I am not going to lead. I'm not going to lead like the world leads. I'm not going to lord it over them. I am going to be a servant. Like, if you actually take that really central Christian vision of what it means to be a leader and say, I'm going to embody that in the political system, I call me a pessimist. I just don't know if that's going to work out well.
I've got another political question, but it's an interesting combination of kind of charismatic prophecy and politics. I don't know if you saw this story, because I know that's another subject you take great joy in debating with Christians about, the charismatic gifts like prophecy. I don't know if you saw the story, but there was a video doing the rounds a couple of weeks ago of an American pastor who had uploaded a prophecy to YouTube, I think back in March, that President Trump would be shot. There'd be an assassination attempt, that he would fall to the ground holding his ear, that shortly after this, Trump would become born again. I mean, a really fascinating story, and one of those where you could prove, because of the timestamps, this prophecy was given before the assassination attempt. But nevertheless, that idea, there's two ideas there. One of them is that you can accurately prophesy political events, which I know would be contentious. Love to get your view on that. But I guess secondly, and perhaps more interestingly, this idea that whatever's happened with Trump might cause some kind of a spiritual rebirth in him. I mean, are you seeing any evidence of that? Are you a skeptic of that idea? Because again, people have very strong views on this. There are Christians who say that Trump is a Christian. already, you know. So you know, these are really, I'd say quite divisive issues for a large part of the American church. How do you handle those sorts of issues when they come up?
That's interesting. I have not seen that video. I'll check it out. I've heard of stuff like that. It's usually after the fact the person said, oh, yeah, a year ago I prophesied. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, so that's interesting if the actual prophecy was time stamped earlier. So predicting that Trump would be shot doesn't seem interesting. I mean, I feel like everybody wants to shoot Trump in America. That's not the fact that one got through. I don't mean to make light of it. That's a horrible thing. But I mean, it wasn't like, wow, somebody tried to. Well, yeah. I mean, 35% of Democrats, according to one poll, wishes he had killed him. You know, like, that's pretty horrifying, I think. I have heard, I have not, Sam, I have not followed this closely, but I have heard other journalists that I do trust, but I don't really trust any. I always need to fact check the journalists.
Don't trust journalists, Preston. That's a bad direction to go in. You're speaking to one after all. I should know. I'm joking, obviously. Well, yeah.
To qualify the journalists that when I do fact check, when I do my own deep dive, I'm like, yeah, they're actually right. And then I think they have a decent reputation. Anyway, they said that that Trump has had a weird change of tone that's very unexpected of Trump. And some people have said, yeah, that they think that incident kind of rattled him a little bit. So I don't know. Could he become a Christian? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar became a believer, I guess, for a period of time at least. So yeah. The prediction, I hope, like you kind of hinted at it, the Bible predicts political events. Daniel chapter 11, the book of Revelation. That doesn't mean that the politician that is in the prophecy is therefore like good. Like,
yeah.
It's
an important distinction, though, isn't it? Because I think we've seen this a lot around Trump with those who are wanting to link this in a prophetic way. There is a kind of underlying assumption that, well, because the prophecy is about him, that somehow makes him the good guy. Whereas you say, biblically, there's prophecy about, quote unquote, the bad guys as much as anyone else. Yeah. It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, so I don't know any kind of possible conversion. It's hard because he's already kind of presented himself as a Christian. So if he did have kind of a spiritual experience, it would have, yeah.
Is part of your argument here for the US church and for your context almost that politics, I mean, some people have called politics a bit of a modern idol, but certainly that politics has almost started to matter to the church just way much more than it should. And even in this interview, I'm asking you about politics, we could be talking about all sorts of other stuff. Is that part of the problem here, that we've all perhaps just become a bit too obsessed with what's happening in Washington or London or wherever it is, and we kind of forget that the church is called to some other things that are quite distinct from that?
I don't think the first century church would have divided over which Caesar took the throne. No, it's Nero. Well, no, Nero's better than Caligula. No, we like Caligula. You know what? We're going to go plant our own church because you guys are for Nero. We're for Caligula. You just don't get the sense that the church, and I know it's a different situation, but it becomes almost comical, you know, or the Jewish exiles, you know, complaining about Babylon's immigration policy. There's too many Assyrians jumping over the wall. What are we doing? We need to build a bigger wall. We need to, like, I think the Jewish exiles, but we're here and we're good citizens, but we're not that invested in the Babylonian ways of ruling the world, because at the end of the day, God's going to crush Babylon. God's going to crush the Roman Empire. Dare I say, God will crush, this is what Daniel 2:44 or 2:42 says, the kingdom of God will crush these empires, in as much as the United States is a worldly empire, and I think it is in that purview. God's going to crush it. He's not going to redeem it. He's going to try to save people within it, but these worldly systems are not on God's side. So, yeah, I do think, that's not even debated, I don't think, that the American church has seen politics profoundly as an idol. And I think that is, in 2020, especially 2016, 2020, and I think my own prophecy is 2024, that the church is dividing over secular politics. And it's like, that's just, who wins there? Satan has to be laughing, doubled over laughing. He's like, I don't even need to like get this people to divide over like gospel, like they're Christian stuff. All I have to do is get them to divide over like which dragon is better than the other, you know, like that's just like nobody, Satan wins there, you know, when the church divides over secular politics. So yeah, I just want Christians to wake up and smell the gospel. Really.
It's a great line. The new book is out now. It's called Exiles, The Church in the Shadow of Empire. Preston's the author of many other books, do check them out on some of the subjects we've had time to cover. Preston, I've really enjoyed asking you just a few of the many thousands of questions that I had. This could go on for some time, but sadly, we are now out of time. Preston Sprinkle, thank you very much for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.